British Prime Minister Liz Truss announces yet another major military aid to Ukraine for next year. Pro-Russia separatists in several parts of Ukraine will hold referendums on joining Russia in the coming days. An opinion poll shows incumbent Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro lagging behind his main rival Lula da Silva this ahead of the October presidential election. This is World News, live from our Tehran headquarters, with me, your host, Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, the UK doubling down on its support for Ukraine. Prime Minister Liz Truss is pledging to provide at least another $2.6 billion in military aid to Kyiv next year. She also described Ukrainian forces' recent advances as inspirational. Truss, who's in New York for the UN General Assembly meeting, also pledged to rally support for Ukraine at the event. The UK is already the second largest military donor to Ukraine after the US. London has supplied Kyiv with a range of weapons, including long-range rockets, anti-tank missiles, and air defense batteries. Britain is also training Ukrainian military on the field. Our correspondent Robert Carter earlier joined us and said that London's decision as regards the war in Ukraine could directly affect the lives of Britons.
Of course, I mean, that's arguably is one of the main reasons why the West in general tends to be very interested in basically what's been described by others as a death economy, keep war abroad going so that we can make a profit from that and keep our wealth in the Western world, at least the wealth within the establishment, going very strong. Of course, there are major arms firms which are going to benefit tremendously from ongoing conflict in Ukraine. We've seen Western arms manufacturers benefit greatly from a long and pointless, totally avoidable war in Yemen, for example. So, of course, there are going to be major benefactors from ongoing crisis in Ukraine. But the fact of the matter is that the ordinary British person is beginning to have direct consequences to their living standards as a result of this particular conflict, and that's why I think it is being looked at differently in comparison to, say, conflicts which Britain and America have supported for a long time in other parts of the world, like Africa and in the Middle East and so on.
Pro-Russia separatists in several Ukrainian regions say that they will be holding referendums on joining Russia in the coming days. Russian media have cited sources saying that the self-proclaimed Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics will hold votes on secession from Ukraine by the end of this month. Authorities in the Russian-controlled southern Kherson region have requested a similar referendum. Ukraine's southeastern region of Zaporizhia is also reportedly eyeing a vote on joining Russia. Moscow says it's up to the residents of those regions to decide if they want to be part of Russia. Ukraine has reacted to coordinated moves, pledging to eliminate Moscow's threats. In 2014, the Crimea Peninsula formally broke away from Ukraine and joined Russia following a referendum there. Now, as for updates regarding the fighting in Ukraine, government forces have advanced further into the east, reclaiming more areas from Russian troops. A video posted on social media shows Ukrainian soldiers walking on a road in Bilohorivka after regaining control of the area just west of the Russian-held city of Lysychansk. According to Ukrainian officials, the soldiers are now in full control of the area and preparing to retake the entire Luhansk province. Ukrainian troops have launched a counteroffensive in the eastern region since driving Russian forces out of Kharkiv province earlier this month. Meantime, the Russian Defense Ministry says its forces destroyed an armored vehicle repair plant in southern Ukraine. Russia is urging Armenia and Azerbaijan to resolve their territorial disputes through negotiations as fighting flares up again between the two southern Caucasian regions.
I emphasize that we are seriously concerned about any conflict situations between states that are close to us. We call on everyone to show restraint, to observe the ceasefire strictly, and to firmly follow the trilateral statements by the leaders of Russia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia.
The Russian president made a comment in a televised speech. Fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani forces first erupted last week. The two former Soviet republics have reported more than 200 fatalities. The two neighbors are bitter rivals and have been clashing over ethnical and territorial issues since the late 1980s. Last week, a ceasefire put a temporary stop to the bloodshed. The latest clashes are the deadliest since the 2020 war that was ended with a Russia-brokered truce. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in New York City to attend the 77th UN General Assembly Summit. The significance of the trip is not just about Iran's presence at the UN, but rather Iran addressing the world from a position of strength. Perhaps at no other time in history has the West appeared to be in a weaker position compared to Iran, that has placed diplomacy at the heart of its foreign policy.
When it comes to Iran and the UN General Assembly this year, one of the questions asked was whether the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi would meet and talk with the U.S. President Joe Biden. The answer was pretty clear.
You're off to New York. You're going to speak at the United Nations. You know, President Biden is going to be there. Are you open to a meeting with President Biden, a face-to-face?
No, I don't think that such a meeting would happen.
I don't believe having a meeting or talk with him will be beneficial.
But this issue should not be the focus, because Iran's presence at this year's assembly means so much more than just whether Raisi will meet Biden or not. So much has changed since Ebrahim Raisi spoke at last year's UNGA.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Iran is the land of culture and civilization.
The transformation of Iran from just a year ago to the current Islamic Republic today is quite remarkable, especially on the international arena. But how has Iran changed? For example, Ebrahim Raisi has been able to turn the table when it comes to harsh and cruel U.S. bilateral sanctions. His administration has turned Iran's economy around, with Iran's GDP and foreign trade to have increased. No easy task when it comes to it being executed. Another example, he kept true to his word and did not link Iran's economic challenges or progress to the JCPOA revival or sanctions removal talks. That has had an impact on an international level, since he showed in action that economic problems could be solved without a deal with the U.S. and some Western countries. Furthermore, when it comes to negotiations, Iran is not negotiating from a weak economic position. An economy that is rebounding strongly, it has beaten the maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. exerted on it. The important achievements of this administration can be seen here. They have elevated Iran's standing, not only domestically, but also on the world stage. And the reason why this is important is because it flies smack in the face of U.S. and Western sanctions, showing how Iran can withstand these unilateral coercive measures and progress at the same time.
Well, the world today is facing a number of major crises, which is why the 77th annual summit of the UN could not come at a better time. From the perspective of Iran, many of the major problems stem from unilateralism. Some of the outcomes of this unilateralism are sanctions, terrorism, and war. Instead of choosing peace and diplomacy as enshrined in the UN Charter, the U.S. has chosen war and unilateralism instead to face the world's crises.
This is what the UN Charter, Article 2, states. All members shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means, in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. A comparative look between Iran versus the U.S. makes it glaringly clear that the U.S. is acting in the opposite direction of this charter. It has indeed taken a militaristic approach when it comes to making a choice between war and peace. It is worth noting that to this day, Iran has not invaded any country or indeed started a war in more than two centuries, something that the U.S. cannot claim. As a matter of fact, recently Iran may have set a new record for hosting foreign dignitaries. In a matter of 1 week, not a day went by when a high-ranking official was not in Iran, which included figures like the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the likes. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi will be making his presence coming up fresh from his appearance at the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. This is important, since Iran has become a permanent member of this organization. And the reason for this importance is, unlike claims made by the U.S. and the West, Iran is an important fixture on the world stage.
In recent years, political and economic multilateralism has come under serious threat. The U.S. government is trying to impose its demands and domestic law on the international system and sovereign countries through outright bullying and coercion. Washington's unilateralism is undoubtedly aimed at hampering independent countries' progress.
The SCO is the world's largest regional organization, covering approximately 60% of the area of Eurasia, 40% of the world population, and more than 30% of the global GDP. Yet a recent incident took place that did not get much coverage, but it displayed how the Islamic Republic has peaceful intentions when it comes to conflicts and can act as a mediator. It had to do with the Ukraine conflict. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amiri Abdollahian, delivered a European peace initiative on Ukraine to Russia, in which Iran said it had received the proposal from an anonymous European leader. This squarely pits Iran's peaceful intentions against the U.S. warmongering policy when it comes to Ukraine. So, when Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi takes the podium, representing Iran and his peaceful intentions, like its peaceful nuclear program, it is showing how Iran deserves the respect that it is entitled to, not the sanctions and embargoes imposed by the West and the U.S.
Now, moving on with the rest of this newscast. Less than 2 weeks ahead of Brazil's presidential elections, an opinion poll shows incumbent Jair Bolsonaro lagging behind his main rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. According to an IPEC survey, the far-right president is backed by 31% of voters, that against 47% who support former President Lula. The study expects a runoff in which Lula would win by 54% of the ballots against 35% for Bolsonaro. The incumbent has seen his popularity drop due to his controversial management of the coronavirus pandemic and the economy. He says that he will retire from politics if he fails to win the upcoming vote.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan. The same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, Presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né?
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Ethiopia's flashpoint northern Tigray region is heading for yet another conflict. A local paramilitary group accusing neighboring Eritrea of launching a full-scale offensive in border areas. Spokesman for the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, says that Ethiopian government troops have also joined the offensive. Neither Eritrean nor Ethiopian government officials have responded to the accusations. Tigray plunged into bloodshed 2 years ago after the federal government launched a war on forces loyal to TPLF. Addis Ababa then also imposed a blockade on the region after rebels refused to pull out of the areas they'd captured in Afar and Amhara regions. Months of fighting left hundreds of people dead and tens of thousands more displaced. A Yemeni human rights group has released a report on what it calls Saudi Arabia's violations of a UN-backed truce since its beginning in April. Our correspondent Sana has more in his report.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians. Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sides in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Atrocities and wrongs suffered by indigenous peoples around the world have been put under the spotlight as a result of the death of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II. We have taken a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story. When newly elected Indigenous Australian parliamentarian Lydia Thorpe took her oath of office last month, she raised her fist above her head in protest and labelled Queen Elizabeth II a colonising queen. It was like kneeling to the murderer, the Green senator told the Reuters news agency this week. I had to swear my allegiance to a colonising power that had caused so much harm to our people. The death of Queen Elizabeth II has led First Nation peoples from Canada to Australia and former colonies in the Caribbean islands to speak about their pain and their marginalisation, as well as renewing calls for the removal of the monarchy as head of state in some countries. The accession of King Charles III comes amid a rise in anti-colonialism fueled by a growing awareness of historical atrocities and a greater recognition of Indigenous culture and knowledge. There's rising popular consciousness around injustices around the world, what's carried out in the name of one's own nation for the exploitation of Indigenous peoples, said Weldon Coburn, an indigenous Anishinaabe professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He added, almost overlapping with Queen Elizabeth's reign from the 1950s, you also see resistance movements emerging. Calls are growing in some Caribbean countries for reparation payments and an apology for slavery, while Canadian Indigenous leaders want the British monarchy to act on a swathe of historical injustices. Australia is on a path to give Aboriginal people a formal voice on Indigenous matters in Parliament. But Thorpe contrasted the government's decision to hold a day of mourning for the Queen with the historical neglect of Indigenous Australians. It is just another nail in the coffin in terms of how we feel and how we are treated as First Nations people, she said. It's like we never existed. The changing demographic in Commonwealth nations and accusations of racism in the royal family following the exit of Prince Harry and Meghan has led to more questions about the need for a distant monarch as head of state. A decision by Barbados to ditch the Queen Elizabeth II as head of state in November of 2021 was seen as a boost for the Republican cause and has been echoed in other Caribbean nations such as Jamaica and Bahamas. Opinion polls in Australia, New Zealand, Canada have all pointed to a growing view that they should end ties to the British monarchy with the death of Queen Elizabeth II. Even though this is unlikely anytime soon in countries like Canada. In New Zealand, indigenous Maori people account for about 17% of the country's 5 million population. They are well represented in Parliament. Maori has been made an official language of New Zealand, and the history of British colonisation is taught in public schools. Maoris are also overrepresented in prisons and state care in New Zealand, and the community remains the country's poorest section of the population. If we can't address the negativity and impact of colonization now, then when? Do we wait for Prince William or Prince William's children? Asked Maori Party co-leader Debbie Ngarewa-Paka, who supports abolishing the monarchy and a New Zealand head of state. No one taking that role, king or queen, princess or prince, is unaware of the damage of colonization to us as indigenous peoples, she said. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has said she expects New Zealand to become a republic eventually, but not anytime soon. Australia's Labour Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who openly favours a republic, has asked a minister with making this happen. But any change would require a referendum in Australia and is only expected if the government wins a second term in office. In Canada, polls suggest about half of all people believe the country should end ties to the British monarchy with the death of Queen Elizabeth II. Indigenous peoples of Canada account for less than 5% of Canada's population of about 38 million people. And they suffer from higher levels of poverty, unemployment, and a lower life expectancy than other sections of the Canadian population. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has taken a look at opposition to Britain's monarchy within the population of Britain itself. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has covered the story from this angle. The controversy over the right to protest in the United Kingdom has come under the spotlight since the death of Queen Elizabeth II, as British police's handling of anti-Montague protests has been criticised. The controversy came amid the shockwave caused by the death of Queen Elizabeth II last week after her 70-year-long reign. British police arrested a woman in Edinburgh for holding an anti-monarchy sign reading "Not My King," targeting the new monarch, King Charles III, according to local media reports. A protester who shouted and called Prince Andrew, who was the centre of attention after being forced by Buckingham Palace to resign from all of his public roles over a scandal involving Jeffrey Epstein, a sick old man, was the first to face arrest. The incident took place during the procession that took Queen Elizabeth II's coffin from the Palace of Holyrood House to St. Giles Cathedral, and a 22-year-old man who was arrested after being manhandled and shoved by some public members, and a video of it has been largely circulated over social media. In a separate incident, a barrister was warned in London by police that a placard saying "Not my king" would see him arrested. The barrister was holding an empty placard. The reaction to the arrest has mounted on social media almost immediately after they took place, with many human rights activists joining. The campaign group Republic has written to police forces in Britain to raise concerns about the latest arrests and notice that it expects protests ahead of the coronation to be allowed to go ahead peacefully. Civil liberties groups and MPs have also expressed alarm.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 30th sermon of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, in Nahjul Balagha, where he explains about a certain event in history, and that was the murder of Uthman, especially at the time when people started to uprise against Imam Ali, alayhi salam. That group of Bani Umayyah that felt that Imam Ali alayhi salam played a role in fighting, in killing Uthman, which is not the case. If you look at history, how Imam Ali alayhi salam sent water to the castle of to the palace of Uthman, where Uthman was given water to drink, and how Imam Ali alayhi salam also tried to advise some people, you know, to give time and kind of advise Uthman, the third caliph, but of course. That didn't happen, as we said in the previous session. Imam Ali alayhi salam complains to Uthman that you listen to me, but your heart is with people like Muawiyah, people like Walid, people like Marwan. Anyways, what happened in history. Now, when Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about this, is he trying to defend himself? to defend himself because of the stance he took. As we said, Imam Ali alayhi salam did not stop the murderers of Uthman. He didn't stop them. They, in their situation, were taking steps against injustice. So now that he didn't stop them, and that was his stance, it was his very clear stance, his clear, bold stance. He says this clearly, that I do not wish to be a supporter of Uthman, never. And this clear stance means that Imam Ali alayhi salam was not coming to defend himself. Rather, he was narrating this issue in history for a very important reason that inshallah we shall come to in the coming segment.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are talking about a situation now that there is a leader, Imam Ali alayhi salam. There are people who are trying to uprise against him. There is another group of people that have seen injustices of Uthman and they want justice to prevail. They want Imam Ali alayhi salam to clearly take a stance and take a just step. At the same time, there are people who supported Uthman and they saw the unfortunately, the injustices that were taking place at his time, but still they supported. Why? Because of certain ulterior motives. And now, again today, they're fighting against Imam Ali alayhi salam and uprising. Now, what can Imam Ali alayhi salam do? What can a leader do in this situation? Imam Ali alayhi salam doesn't come and defend himself. He says something clearly in history. He mentions his stance clearly. There's nothing to be afraid of for Imam Ali alayhi salam. But why Imam Ali alayhi salam is mentioning these things in the sermon is so that when a certain fitna or a certain, you can say, problem happens in the society, whereby there is now there are people fighting against one another, there is an uprising happening, how do you deal with it? You deal with it by raising the awareness, by giving the analytical strength to the people. To impart that skill of being able to analyze social events and political events. And that is what Imam Ali alayhi salam is doing here. He's imparting some experience. He's giving them a lesson in trying to interpret history. وَأَنَا جَامِعٌ لَكُمْ أَمْرًا And I am going to kind of round up this issue. How am I going to round up this issue? I'm going to round up this issue like this. By explaining to you the situation, by giving you that ability and the skill to understand the situation at that time, to recognize that there was some level of injustice that was happening, to recognize that there was a rightful movement against that injustice, to recognize the fact that supporting injustice at that time is a crime in itself, and therefore those people who are supporting injustice in the name of injustice, not in the name of the third caliph, in the name of that injustice, are definitely oppressive people. And they had no privilege to impart this knowledge, to give them that awareness, to critically analyze and to dissect that event in history, is what a leader, a true leader, a strong leader, a powerful leader does. And that is exactly what Imam Ali alayhi salam does. This is an amazing part in history. And everyone should really contemplate on these words to understand the gravity of the strength of Imam Ali alayhi salam's wisdom in his leadership.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when we look at history, and that is something that is very important for us to realize, that whenever certain things happen in history, there are certain reactions that occur. Groups are formed, right? you notice that when a certain event happens, there are groups, one who supports that event, one who against that event. There are personalities that sprout out, that, you know, kind of act for or against. All these things happen. But Imam Ali didn't come and give them all this knowledge as a history lesson. People saw that thing happening in history. It was not a history lesson. It was rather an experiment ground, an observational field that Imam Ali alayhi salam was laying down for the people to see. He was giving them an opportunity to look, to think clearly, to analyze. You see, one of the things that happens, unfortunately, is that when difficulties happen, when problems in the society happens, when clashes happen, there is so much dust that covers the eyes of the people that sometimes they don't even know what happened. They need someone to break down the events and clarify it for them stepwise what exactly is happening. As a means, as an introductory phase to explain to them the lessons that they can learn from this. So now Imam Ali alayhi salam is clearly now, nicely placing this observational ground, this observatory ground, placing all the characters in the right places, dissecting it, analyzing it, keeping it in order, and now allowing people to sit down and observe. And this is another very powerful role of a leader, of a right leader. And inshallah, let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we can emulate these qualities from the master of the faithful people. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means.
Thank you. In the limelight. The American people are still struggling with rising costs, and the situation isn't going to change anytime in the near future. We have prepared for you an article written by Gene Marks. The piece is titled U.S. Inflation Isn't Going Away. Small businesses must plan ahead. According to a report recently issued by the U.S. National Federation of Independent Businesses, inflation is the top challenge facing small businesses this year, with a whopping 91% admitting that rising prices are having either a substantial or a moderate impact on their companies. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says that nearly 7 in 10 small businesses have raised prices to cope with inflation, which is also considered their dominating challenge. 65% of small business respondents in a Goldman Sachs study said rising input costs have forced them to raise the price of their goods and services this year, with almost 80% saying the economy has gotten worse over the past 3 months. U.S. officials claim if Americans are having inflationary challenges in their business, they're not alone. However, they say there is some good news for them. And, unfortunately, some bad news as well. The good news is that inflation appears to be plateauing. They claim prices for core materials such as industrial chemicals, construction supplies, copper, aluminium, plastics, packaging, iron and steel, and even agriculture products like fertilizer and processed feeds are either leveling off or not rising quickly. The price of lumber products has dropped significantly from their highs last year. Oil prices are down 30% from earlier this summer. But this is partly because the world's supply chain is beginning to show signs of normalcy. Port traffic in Long Beach, California is down to 84 ships off the coast, significantly less than during the pandemic. Mass lockdowns in China have ended, and the Baltic Dry Index, a key measure of freight costs and shipping demand, has fallen almost 30% since the beginning of the year. There's also been a general slowdown in the world's demand for goods, which, while not great, has certainly affected prices. It's doubtful whether the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act, regardless of the positive impact it should have on our climate and healthcare problems, will have much impact on inflation. Penn's Wharton School says that the bill would actually increase inflation until 2024 and has low confidence that the legislation will have any impact on inflation. But officials claim the good news is that government spending has significantly decreased, and the U.S. Federal Reserve is no longer pouring fuel under fire. This brings me to the bad news. We're still struggling with rising costs, and the situation isn't going to change anytime in the near future. Producer prices, at 11.3% as of June, are still up well over historical levels. And because the Producer Price Index is considered a leading indicator, that means that ultimately consumer prices will remain at elevated levels for months to come. It took a year and a half for inflation to reach these levels. Consumer prices began rising in March 2021
and hit 7% by the end of 2021, well before Russia's special operation in Ukraine. It's going to take at least that long for it to return to the more sustainable levels we've seen in the past. It may take even longer. That's because there are lots of obstacles in the way of significantly taming inflation. Some economists, notably former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, believed the Federal Reserve's moves aren't aggressive enough. Further pressure from the Ukraine conflict could elevate energy and food prices, particularly as we head into the winter months. More COVID cases in China could once again disrupt the supply chain, even if the world economy begins to grow significantly again in the near future. That growth could put strains on US fragile supply chains and disrupt pricing for many of the core materials Americans buy. What is clear is that when and if prices do start to fall, it is going to take time, and in some sectors, a lot more time than in others. Nor is declining overall inflation a guarantee that prices will not rise in some areas again. The energy sector, particularly gasoline prices, have played a huge role in soaring inflation rates. Compared to last year, energy prices were up 41% in June, and gas price alone were up 60%. According to federal government statistics, Americans are using less gas this summer. Gas consumption in the United States is now over 1 million barrels a day, below levels that were seen in the summer of 2020, which was already lower than what was seen pre-pandemic. Despite falling demand, it is still unclear how long the low gas prices will last. The energy market is extremely volatile. Some analysts have warned that gas prices could go up again in the fall as stricter sanctions against Russian oil are set to start in December. The OPEC cartel of oil-producing nations agreed to an increase in oil output that is seemingly in a snub to Joe Biden, their smallest increase ever. Like the energy market, the food sector is highly volatile as well, as it is also sensitive to geopolitical relations and climate. The food index increased 10.9% over the last year, the largest 12-month increase since the period ending May of 1979. A number of factors went into the rising food prices, including a highly infectious avian flu that wiped out many chickens across the country. Tyson Foods, one of the largest meat producers in America, said that labor shortages and higher grain prices played a role in rising meat prices. The pandemic induced a shortage of semiconductor chips, which are used in everything from phones to television sets to cars, that is still being seen today. The shortage is squeezing the car industry. Analysts are predicting that the low number of new car sales, which dropped 12% year over year in July, will continue throughout to the end of summer as the supply of cars continues to be sparse. According to Cox Automotive, the average price for a new car hit a record $48,000 in June. In July, Americans were paying 10.4% more for new vehicles and 6.6% more for used cars compared with the year before. That's a dramatic fall from earlier this year. In January, used cars were 44.6% higher than they were at the start of 2021. But it still means prices are rising and from a high base. Though the chip shortage does not affect the used car market directly, fewer new cars means that people are holding on to their cars rather than buying new ones. The Senate just passed a bipartisan bill that provides $52 billion in subsidies to chip manufacturers in the United States and investment into developing a more robust domestic chip industry, though any impact from the bill on the car industry will not be seen for some time. Though used car prices showed signs of easing earlier in the summer, they still remain historically high and will probably remain so for the near future. Economists argue that it is possible that inflation has hit its peak, and there are signs that many of the pressure behind inflation are easing, but it is still hard to predict the path that inflation will take. Some of the prices being seen today, like for gas and homes, will probably continue to go down, but other costs will, in the best-case scenario, stay put. The process of turning inflation is unpleasant. Fewer people can afford to buy houses or new cars, and businesses have less money to expand. But getting inflation down is necessary for the economy to get back to a healthy balance between supply and demand.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful hadith which has been narrated from Imam Jafar as-Sadiq alayhi salam. This hadith is about dua and supplication. More specifically, it is about those supplications which are not answered. The Imam alayhi salam in this hadith, he divides the categories of people whose du'as and supplications are not answered, into four categories. This is a very beautiful hadith, very informative. You know, a lot of people ask, why aren't our supplications answered? You know, even though we ask God for something, and a lot of times the du'a, the supplication, is not answered. So this hadith kind of sheds light on, you know, the reason perhaps why this is so. Let's look at this beautiful hadith and see if we can come to any conclusion regarding this. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, there are four kinds of people whose supplications do not get answered. The man who sits in his house saying, so the first is the man who sits in his house saying, oh my Lord, grant me sustenance. Right? So there's a person, he sits in his house, he doesn't do anything, he doesn't go out looking for work or sustenance, but he simply prays and says, oh God, give me sustenance. God doesn't answer the prayers of this person. The imam says, to whom he, in other words God, says, did I not command you to seek for your sustenance? Did I not command you to go out and look for your sustenance and seek your sustenance? Allah Ta'ala doesn't answer the prayers of this person. The second category is this. Then there is the man who has a wife and supplicates against her. Right? So there's a person, he has a wife, and this person supplicates and prays for the detriment, or to the detriment of his wife. Right? You know, he doesn't like his wife, he has a problem with his wife, and, you know, regardless of whether, you know, he's right in that regards or he's wrong, but he prays against her, he curses her, he asks God to give her harm, to harm her. Right? In response to such a person, God Almighty replies, did I not make you responsible for her? Did I not put her affairs in your hands? Right? Why are you, you know, cursing your wife? Why are you calling harm down upon your wife? Why are you asking me to harm your wife when, you know, I have placed her, you know, in your care? This is another person whose prayers are not answered. The third is a man who has wealth and wastes it. Somebody's been given wealth, he's wealthy, or not wealthy, but he has some wealth, and he wastes it away. This person says, oh my Lord, grant me sustenance. And on the one hand, God has given him sustenance, and he's wasting it, spending it without care, and it's finishing. So he's praying to God to give him sustenance. And to whom God replies, did I not command you to be economical? Right? God commanded us to be economical, but this person is wasting his wealth away. So God doesn't answer the prayers of this person. And finally, there is a man who has wealth and loans it to someone without keeping any proof of the loan. Right? So he may have given a loan to somebody, but he doesn't write it down. Right? And you know, he squanders it away. To whom God replies, did I not command you to take a witness? Did I not command you to take a witness? Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the categories of people whose supplications are not answered in the words of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The passing away of Queen Elizabeth II may be a sad day for a lot of people. At the same time, there are many who do not think about the Queen in positive terms. The massacre, for example, in Northern Ireland, or the chemical attack by British forces in Iraq, the role it played in a coup against Iran's Mossadegh government are just some of the things that have happened during her watch over in the UK. Now, in this edition of The Spotlight, we're going to review some of the atrocities. We will look at the expense.